From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Right now, at my home of KCRW, there's an elephant in the room. There have been charges of racism and instances of microaggressions towards people of color that have been aired publicly. It's been difficult and painful and profoundly disappointing. But it's created an opportunity for a lot of organized, deep, internal work of a kind that's going on in many organizations now. The phrase, be the change you want to see in the world, has never felt more apt at KCRW than now. Because this work takes time and builds on itself, there's a gap between our public and private face that's created trepidation for people of affected communities in making the decision to be guests on our show. We accept this and understand that the onus is on us to create a more welcoming and equitable environment inside our space that reflects the work we broadcast to the world. And so when we respond to the hate and horror inflicted on the AAPI community, we especially want to thank those guests who have put their trust in us to understand their pain. This institution has a lot of work to do. I used to believe that I could let my own work speak for me, but I realize now that I need to say all of this out loud and make a public commitment to you to work harder and do better for our colleagues and our listeners. Today on the show, we're going to chew on some big ideas about race and gender and how they intersect with food and hospitality. We've invited Professor Karen Tongson to guest host this episode, and I can't imagine anyone I'd rather listen to on the topic. Karen is the department chair and a professor at USC's Department of Gender and Sexuality Studies. She teaches a class called Food Culture and Food Politics, which I've visited several times as a guest. And the issues she explores in this class are what I consider to be the urgent issues of our time. I want to welcome Karen, or KT as you'll hear her called, to Good Food. Hi.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for having me here today.
I realize that a lot of people listening may have no idea that institutions like KCRW or the one you work at, USC, are going through these tough moments.
I think that's true. And I do want to start by saying how much I appreciate your candor and the accountability of your opening statement, Evan. There's a longer history to these moments of reckoning with racism and sexism at places like KCRW and USC. So I guess what I want to say at the beginning is that this isn't just a moment in the wake of terrible things happening, like the killings of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, the Atlanta shootings, the daily barrage of violence that you'll hear us talking some about today against people of color, women, and trans people. But I do think that the social inequities laid bare by the pandemic have really shone an unrelenting light on these problems and demanded accountability from those of us who've invested our labor, care, and time in the places where we're trying to do good work, but coming up against the prejudices baked into these institutions. So I'm with you in hoping that we can be the change and that our workplaces live up to the challenge of transforming the culture of not only where we work, but the world we live in. So thanks for letting me be a voice as part of that change today.
Oh, I'm so grateful to have you. So let's talk about you for a minute. I understand that you come from a famed Filipino musical family.
Yeah, my folks, my mom's side of the family in particular, were known for innovating Latin jazz in the Philippines in the 50s, 60s, and onward. And so music was the family business.
So your academic career is grounded in an investigation of gender and sexuality studies. How did you start to bring an interest in food into the picture?
Well, when I just described being surrounded by music in my life growing up in Manila and then at different parts here in the U.S., those nights of music were also nights of feasting and food. So my grandmother always hosted mahjong games in our carport in Manila, and there'd be food cooking of all forms nonstop for hours. And I think that that's just sort of how I expected life to be forever, is this kind of scene of music, food, and conviviality. And I describe myself as a food enthusiast, not necessarily as a food expert, an informed enthusiast. And because I love reading so much about food, consuming it, obviously, and sharing experiences of food with so many different people, I figured I might as well incorporate it into my teaching, though I haven't incorporated it into my scholarship yet, because I kind of want to keep the pleasures of it all without torturing myself by having to work on these things in these serious ways, or having to produce, you know, scholarship about it. I want to keep the kind of the pleasure elements of it alive for myself.
I think I encourage you to remain an amateur in that way. Well, I can't wait to hear today's conversation, and I hand it over to you, Karen. And once again, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Evan. And here we go. Last week, there was a scathing article in the Washington Post quoting Asian and Asian American actresses, scholars, and activists about how Hollywood has failed them, has failed us for decades. I was really struck by something the filmmaker, scholar, and a former mentor of mine, Celine Paranya Shimizu, said in that piece, quote, "In Hollywood, most of the time we don't actually feel for Asian Americans. We see them in service of others." Framing Asians and Asian women in particular as submissive, exotic, and in service to others in various ways has infiltrated all aspects of our culture, including the world of food, which, let's not forget, is the service industry. Joining me to discuss these difficult topics today are writer and food critic Esther Tsang and chef Min Fan of Fennekite and Porridge and Puffs. Hi, Min.
Hi, Karen. Thank you for having me.
Hi, Esther.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
And so, you know, I want to start by acknowledging what a difficult and exhausting time it's been to be Asian and Asian American women in particular. Every day there's another news item, another snippet of violent footage. And I know that just in the last couple of days, I've found myself reeling from the video of the Filipino American woman who was assaulted in front of a building in Manhattan. As a doorman shut the door and as people sort of turned the other way. And I think it's important to sort of talk about that exhaustion as we kind of open a conversation about service and what that means to be of service and how it resonates differently when we talk about this in relation to AAPI folks, to Asian women in particular. And I'm wondering, you know, how you would begin to make some of the connections between what Celine Paranya said, this idea of the kind of, first of all, monolithic notion of Asianness and Asian women. How would you begin to break that apart, especially in relation to some of the things we see in the food world and food industry?
Addressing your monolithic comment, which is really on the nose and such a huge problem of what we've all been facing, is that we're not a monolith. And me personally, I'm Taiwanese American, and I am a member of, quite frankly, a privileged set of the AAPI group. And, you know, historically, we have come over with the most education of any AAPI group. So what I make sure I do in all my food reporting or any kind of culture reporting is just address this idea of a monolith and use my privilege to really stress that we are all so diverse. We have Southeast Asian, we have South Asian, and a lot of the visibility goes to the Eastern Asian population.
I think that's something really important to address, that we're not a monolith, but using the strength of a unity is really important. At the same time, for me, being in hospitality is a return to something I love, and that is food is very vibrant and very alive, you know, in the Asian community. You know, something that Esther mentioned about Taiwanese American not being in food as much. I think that's something that's really important, because here's the thing, is most Asian American women I know don't necessarily want to be servers, because we have been long raised to be educated and do something and not be in service.
And I wanted to link what you were just saying, Min, to the very question of visibility itself and whether or not visibility in different ways, as you're kind of describing, isn't always desirable, right? Because sometimes visibility means being made available to an exoticizing gaze. You know, I can speak from the history of Filipino Americans or Filipinos in the U.S. to say that among the first Filipinos brought to the United States were people put on display at the St. Louis World's Fair, right? So in that sense, being visible was not a positive economy of visibility. I know that there are a lot of thoughts swirling around in that set of associations, but I did want to talk about this excessive exoticism ascribed to Asianness and Asian American women, but also to Asian food and how we're working to combat some of these stereotypes in either writing about food or in serving it.
Thankfully, I've been seeing the corner being turned in food media, and I just hope that the public and like the Yelp reviewers and whatnot kind of catch up. Is this concept of authenticity, which I think is very much, it's very closely related to the idea of exoticism. And just this like arbitrary concept of authenticity where some self-appointed arbiter of said authenticity just says, this food is authentic, or this other kind of food is not authentic enough, or it's just so arbitrary. And what it does is erase the kitchen, and it erases the cooks in the kitchen and the entire restaurant's vision for what they wanted to create. And the idea of authenticity is just, it's BS, because the idea is that, like, we all have so many different influences coming from all different angles. And who is anybody to say what is good enough or what is authentic enough for consumption? And it's funny because, like, people of all backgrounds and identities are guilty of this.
I think we, the Asians, are guilty of it more, against ourselves a lot, at my experience. I mean, for me, like an example, you know, we just reviewed it with our team, is people will ask me when I'm running food, they're like, what kind of food is this? And I stand on my foot. You know, you guys have heard me. And I said, this is Californian, specifically Angeleno. And then they're like, No. What kind of food is it? And I know what they're getting at. And I said, well, what do you mean? This is, I come from a lineage of farm to table. My ancestors have been eating farm to table for a gajillion years. You know, we eat what we grow and we eat by the seasons. And I will go through this whole, and it connects really well to Californian. And I said, oh, and then finally I look at them. I said, oh, you're trying to figure out, you know, my mom's Vietnamese. I'm Vietnamese. My mom's a really good Vietnamese cook. And they're like, oh, it's Vietnamese food. I'm like, no. My mom cooks Vietnamese food. If I call this Vietnamese food, my mom would be very upset because my mom's, you know, she considers her food Vietnamese and my food, whatever Min's creating in her crazy head. And I think that's really a hard concept for people. And it is a struggle that is very hard it's been very hard for me as a business. And it's been very hard for me as an artist, because people cannot pinpoint or categorize what we do.
Well, actually, what you were saying, Min, leads me to a question for Esther about how then does a food critic like Esther go about writing about a food experience like the kind you provide, Min, one that, like, that you describe as Angeleno or place-based and has a range of influences from a lot of different places, but is obviously tied to some idea of who you are identity-wise as a chef, how people read your identity or receive it. How do you go about describing foods created by AAPI people that doesn't reinscribe the notions of authenticity, or that the food itself is necessarily quote-unquote Asian food?
I try and get as specific as I can. The fact is that we just need to embrace our differences instead of needing to put our subject in a box. And that's what I try and do in my writing.
That's awesome. Because people love shortcuts. They love lists and they love things being, you know, just distilled and reduced. And I think what's missing a lot and culturally in, you know, the culture right now is context. You know, and I love hearing this, Esther. I wish like everything had context.
Well, actually, speaking of context and how it describes our reception of food and its value, I wanted to ask both of you about how value, or the very question of value itself, differs when we kind of frame it around AAPI food cultures or certain perceptions around AAPI food cultures. For example, what is the value we place on certain Asian cuisines? What are the expectations around them being cheap or accessible versus what you were talking about, Min, this kind of local farm to table, that is not cheap. Those things aren't necessarily compatible.
I think about this a lot because I really adore, you know, the community and as diverse that as it is in all economic levels. I love getting a good by me. And, you know, and it's not the price, but I ask the owners, I said, why do you charge so little? I know how hard this is. This makes me mad, you know, and it's like, you know, my, you know, and I call her auntie or whatever, right? And then they're like, cuz, you know what? I just need enough to live. I just need enough. You know, and I said, yeah, but you work so hard. They're like, I don't need to make money. It's sweat. I just want to put my kid through college. And I said, yeah, but are they going to come back and work here? And they said, well, I don't want them to. I just want to make enough. And I said, why don't you charge more? They're like, because if I charge more, someone's going to open another shop and, you know, charge less. And I'm not going to have a shop anymore. But that's a different mentality than my mentality. I can't exploit anyone. I do exploit myself, but I can't exploit my team. And that's the industry has exploited itself. It's exploited people, either new immigrants, it's exploited family members. But I don't begrudge the system because it's put some of us through college. It's made sure some of us have a better future. But how do we change it now?
I think a huge part of that is education and educating the diner audience. Just as Min said, you know, we have cannibalized ourselves in terms of the industry, and that's so tragic. I mean, I think one of the most recent, like, culture pieces that come to mind is Always Be My Maybe. And I love this movie, you know, and it's just the fact that I know too much and I'm so entrenched in the food world. But the premise and of the movie and the denouement of it was Ali Wong opening up a restaurant and, like, charging in a quote-unquote affordable price for a large amount of food, you know, and her opening that up, that kind of restaurant, where I want to fight for a world where it's not only white chefs who can serve a tasting menu with that come with headphones. You know what I mean? I want Asian chefs to be able to do this too, you know, and not be boxed in and be able to cook this way. And unfortunately, you know, this has to do with educating our own community and, like, teaching our community to support these chefs that are doing what they want to do despite all odds, you know, going against the tide and supporting them in that.
It's such an honor to be able to have this conversation with you and share space with you both. Thank you for spending time with me today.
Thank you both.
Thank you. This was so great.
That was Chef Min Phan of Fennekite and Porridge and Puffs and food writer Esther Tseng. Coming up, would eliminating tips create a more equitable restaurant? We hear from a restaurateur who's on a mission to elevate the labor of all service workers. I'm Karen Tongson, filling in for Evan Kleiman, and I'll be right back after this break.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. I'm Karen Tongson, sitting in for Evan Kleiman. In the wake of the Atlanta shooting that killed six women of Asian descent, Lin Ta responded with an essay. "That could have been my mom," she wrote, "my auntie. Women who worked long hours in the self-care service industry to earn a deserving tip." Lin grew up in the nail salons where her mother, a Vietnamese refugee, made her living painting intricate designs with tiny brushes upon women's fingertips. Decades later, Lin has also become an entrepreneur in the hospitality world. She's the face and spirit behind All Day Baby in Silver Lake and the former Here's Looking at You in Koreatown. And as Los Angeles starts to reopen, Lin is confronted with challenges big and small. How do we change the hospitality industry so that workers are valued? Will we ever get rid of tipping? Does anyone even want to work in restaurants anymore? We invited Lin to the show today to talk about a lot of things, starting with this question. Why is it so hard for restaurants to find workers right now?
I think there's a few things. And, you know, for a long time, it was certainly a safety issue. Rightfully so, employees didn't feel safe to come back to work. Or, you know, obviously the opportunities were not there. We all had to kind of cut back on staff because the business wasn't there. Some of that has to do with, you know, the cost of living in Los Angeles is quite high. So a lot of folks have relocated. You know, for example, I just recently had to, distribute W-2s from last year. And a lot of my former employees are no longer local. I sent them all over the place in this country. Another reason is that there is unemployment, you know, so there's traditional unemployment. There's a weekly 300 supplement. And we recently also received $1,400 per person, I think, if you made less than $75,000. So there are some employees that, you know, are not career restaurant workers, but, you know, did it to subsidize maybe their art career, you know, their musician career, and maybe they don't need that money right now, that extra money that a restaurant job offers them. So there's a few things. And some people just have really been disheartened by the industry altogether, and maybe they just don't want to come back and they want to do something else now. They've got real estate licenses, for example.
This last year has given us a lot of time to reflect on work and how we feel valued. Do you think this is related to the discomfort some people feel in the restaurant world and relying specifically so much on tips?
I certainly have been thinking a lot about it, the value of labor, as you pointed out. And, you know, I think cooks, for example, so long have they been not a part of a tip pool. I really think, you know, that many of them, so I've heard, really have tried to reassess and, well, what else can I do? You know, I'm great at cooking. I love working in restaurants, despite the fact that I didn't make too much money. But now with there being no jobs, or, you know, I'm talking about recently, before, you know, they've had to rethink their path. And for me, I obviously love restaurants. I love the work that we do in spite of how hard it is. And right now the challenges of rehiring, but I would really love in my own small amount of power to reinstate the value of a restaurant worker, even a restaurant owner. I mean, this idea of tipping is old. It relates to classism. You know, it goes back to Civil War times and slavery and all of that. And you know, the restaurant industry has toyed with this and talked about what if we do away with tipping. And I'm thinking a lot about that as well, just because we would be, as restaurant owners, be in a better position to provide more equitable pay. You know, I mean, I've never in my whole life as a restaurant owner made as much as a restaurant server that I've employed. My manager is the same, my chef the same, my cooks for sure the same. You know, and my mom and I, you know, just to relate, you know, I watched her work for tips my whole life. And it was based on, you know, how great of a job she was going to do, but she was going to always do a great job, whether she was going to receive $0 in tip or, you know, 5, 10, or 20. And the same with my team of workers. Their attitude towards doing a wonderful job really has no impact on, like, what they think they're going to receive as far as a tip. In fact, you know, we're very lucky that for a lot of the times when we were a full-service restaurant, our team really did receive great tips. We have generous tippers because they're, you know, they're savvy restaurant diners. Right now in the takeout model, it's less known that tipping is still necessary. So there are people that do not tip the staff, even though it's actually a lot more work right now because there's not a lot of people to help.
You brought up your mom, who I mentioned in the intro, and I really wanted to ask you how watching her work at nail salons for tips is something that influenced your own sense of value as it pertains to women's labor in particular. Tell us a little bit about your earliest memories of being in her salons. Give us a sense of what it was like to be in that atmosphere, to soak up the smells, what was on the walls. What did it sound like?
Well, it smelled of a lot of chemicals. I do recall that. I mean, I really grew up in salons from a very early age. And when I was still living in Southern California at the time, I later moved to Atlanta, Georgia. My mom had this amazing salon in Compton called Annie's Beauty Center. My mom's name is Annie. And I turned 4 at that salon, I recall. But the salon was pretty big and it was split, you know, totally in half. And there were these Asian American women, I would say all immigrants, Vietnamese like my mom or Chinese like my father, on one side of the salon, and then African American women on the second half of the salon. And, you know, pretty much 100% of the clientele were African American. And it was when I was very young. So, I mean, at the time, it seemed really fun to me. I got to, you know, sit at the front with like all of the cute nail charms that. This was the early 80s, so women were affixing on their, like, long sets of, like, curl, the acrylics and stuff. But, you know, my mother and all the other women in the salon, they worked long hours. Maybe the salon would open at 9, 10, and go all the way till 9 and 10. You know, I wouldn't see her growing up. As I grew older, and let's say I was at the salon helping to sweep the floors, like if it was also a hair salon, my mom owned many, many salons throughout my time of growing up. I mean, it was challenging. You're a preteen or a teenager, and you see your mom just hovered over a set of hands all day long. And at times, you know, I've shared that, you know, I'm ashamed to admit that it was embarrassing to me to see my mom do that kind of work. And then now, you know, to come full circle, I think she's embarrassed by me that I'm in the restaurant industry. And you know, and I kept it actually from her for a long time. You know, she didn't know about Here's Looking at You until, I mean, I was kind of forced to tell her because she showed up in LA. And then she only just found out about All Day Baby the other day because I was in this Vietnamese newspaper and it said that I had closed one restaurant and still had one open. And she was like, is this you? And it's just, you know, I think I can now see, in hindsight, I understand now that we both are in this line of service, servitude, and it's hard work, and it's not a lot of payoff. And she wondered probably why in the world did she work this hard so that I could go and get a writing degree, for example, at a liberal arts college in New England, and why in the world did I go and open a restaurant, you know, things that, you know, her family members did in Vietnam, just, you know, finding a means of making ice and then finding coffee and then making Vietnamese iced coffee and carrying it on big baskets on their shoulders and just going door to door. And all of that stuff is perishable, you know? And I mean, it's essentially kind of what we're doing here.
Well, I'm fascinated by the interplay you talk about between, you know, your own sense, perhaps as a first gen kid of watching your mom do what she does and feeling that, you know, tinge of shame that, I mean, I've certainly felt it when I, you know, was watching my mom do something very different. It was still in service. She was a singer, but, you know, you would think, oh, isn't that glamorous to watch your mom performing and singing and doing these things? But actually it just made me acutely aware of an audience consuming her and seeing what you did doing those things. And, you know, I imagine that there's aspects of being in service in the restaurant industry, being a kind of entrepreneur in those ways that are about being made available to people kind of consuming you, consuming what you do in these various ways. And so I just wanted to share that and relate with you and the kind of difficult interplay one has with negotiating these things with one's parents.
Yes, for sure. I mean, I just remember even in grade school, you know, and kids swapping stories, like, what do your parents do? And I would just have so much trouble answering that question because everybody else's parents worked at Coca-Cola and were lawyers. And, you know, obviously she wanted me to be a doctor or a pharmacist or something like that. And, but yeah, performing, you know, I mean, I actually think if she were around more often, she lives in South Carolina right now, but and if she saw me working at the restaurant, I think it would really upset her because obviously, like, I mean, I'm doing a lot of manual labor. I clean up after people and I'm just packing things up and it's all very unusual. I love what I do, obviously, because I wouldn't have gotten myself into this place. But I would love to see some really meaningful change to how we value our workers because it crosses my mind every single day that I would love to pay my workers more. And I think, you know, any kind of non-restaurant worker is probably like, well, why don't you? And it's just like, there's just no money. I don't even pay myself that much. We need help. We need maybe new legislation to not only provide minimum wage, but maybe it needs to not be coupled with this tipping situation too. Like there needs to be something that works better for the restaurant industry or any other service industry.
I really thank you for taking the time to talk with me today and to share so openly and honestly.
Oh, such a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Lynn Ta. Say hi to her next time you pick up a biscuit sandwich from All Day Baby in Silver Lake. Lynn is also a co-founder of Regarding Her Food, a nonprofit devoted to the advancement and empowerment of women restaurateurs. Give them a follow on Instagram at Regarding Her Food. In a minute, I'll introduce you to Sehee Cho, a writer, cook, and stylist who is rethinking the grocery business. I'm Karen Tongson, sitting in for Evan Kleiman. Stay with us. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm your guest host, Karen Tongson. Once a week, a beautiful bag of produce shows up at my door. Sometimes there are also homemade tortillas pressed with flowers, or a cupping pepperoni with two balls of pizza dough, maybe canned Dungeness crab, or soy sauce specifically for eggs. And often there's a handful of Korean sweet treats, all varietals of choco pie, or my favorite, sweet lime and cheese cracker sandwiches. This is the work of Sehee Cho, a writer, cook, and stylist who launched Soon Mini, a grocery delivery business that aims to support local farms and build community, all while contributing to social justice organizations. It's my pleasure to welcome you, Sehee. How are you?
Good. Thank you for having me, Karen.
So you're en route to a farm while we're speaking, and which I guess is completely apt given what Soon Mini does. Could you explain to us a little bit about what Soon Mini is?
So I think to explain what it is, I think it's probably best to explain how it started, which it pretty much started the week that everything shut down, I think the first week of March. And I was just basically delivering complete meals to friends. And then it became really evident that people had an excess of time. And what they actually needed were good ingredients that they could trust rather than prepared meals. So it started as just a very direct way to get healthy, safe produce to people I love. And then they started referring it out to other friends. And then the list got bigger. And then it sort of forced me to talk to other farms and other vendors. And then it started to be 7 or 8 farms that were all local. And then it expanded out further to basically I started carrying third-party items, like specialty cooks, specialty bakers, who had essentially been laid off of their restaurant jobs and needed sort of a new venture, which oddly did this thing where it sort of pushed a lot of, especially women, to create new small businesses. So sort of supporting those businesses in tandem with the farms have sort of developed this community that's really like-minded and really focused on not only spending money, but every dollar is doing more than just consuming. My sense is that this community is interested in making their money work for more than them.
So the producers, the community pantry folks who you have contributing things like jars of chili crisp, right? Which Wax Apple is one of those folks, or some of the other purveyors, the honey that you get, etc. It's not just to sustain them as individuals or businesses, but the money you're collecting is also going to social justice organizations. Could you talk a little bit about the different organizations you've given to and how you began to bake that into the structure of what the Soon Mini Venture does?
Of course. I'm thinking about this a little bit retroactively. I mean, in the beginning, it really felt like during the pandemic, obviously during Black Lives Matter, obviously during this current crisis with the Asian American community, people are really activated to do more. And food being so universal, food being so essential, it actually becomes a really easy hubbing point for people to activate around. Last week, we did a fundraiser for Asian Americans Advancing Justice. It was our biggest week by far, almost by double. People were so angry and upset about what was happening, but there are fewer vehicles for making actionable change. And so, like, thinking about a food model as not only a grocery delivery service, a way to provide food, but to think of it as a way to activate people, to build community. My sense was that people were more generous. They were anticipating their groceries more, and they were also more appreciative. It created this like holistic sense of we're all in it together. The vehicle for that is food. And to me, it makes so much sense that it would be because it is the unifier in all of these things.
I know, for example, that you yourself aren't just a food person. And, you know, one of the things that I appreciate most about the Soon Mini newsletters that you send to subscribers every week is that you offer a bit of writing, often a citation of a poem. And this last week, it was Kathy Park Hong's Minor Feelings. Could you share with us a little bit about how literature, how writing, how other art forms also factors into, you know, this project and the activism that you see yourself participating in?
I mean, I would love to. I feel like that sort of comes into play in two ways. I find it really important for myself not to necessarily choose a lane. I am a food person. I've worked in food for almost 15 years. I'm also a writer. I've been writing for even longer than that. I think we're doing ourselves a disservice to force ourselves to choose a career. My thing is that I would like to live horizontally, which is to have as many experiences as possible, which may not accrue to much, but I will live well in my eyes. And so for me, it was really important to, when I write these newsletters, yes, the food is important because that's essentially what people are buying, but it's also like, it's how you feel. It's how, like, food is generous, the way poetry is generous, the way art is generous. And these things are all in the same family for me. And it just doesn't make sense for me to separate it. And the other side of this is that because I feel like I've lived kind of like the food life world and then a writing life world and then actually a fashion life world for a little bit, all of these three realms of my life are sort of hubbing at Soon Mini because all three of these communities are sort of have become loyal customers. And they are all unified by social justice causes, by a desire to support local farms and businesses. And so to find those commonalities has been really beautiful.
And you've referred to the Soon Mini sort of, I guess, clientele as a community and as family. And I know from your Instagram and from the other ways that you express yourself online that you have a really close relationship to your family and to your mom in particular. Could you share with us what your and your family's relationship to food is?
I mean, I could talk about that endlessly. I mean, I think from a macro level, I think from an immigrant family, I think this is true of a lot of cultures, that the table is where we commune, where language lacks, where culture lacks, where common sort of experience lacks. Food bridges that gap really well and easily. And then in addition, my mom is just a brilliant cook. I remember she was in dental school when I was, I don't know, 3 or 4. And every day she would pack us the most extravagant lunch that I know. Like, she would pack these rice balls with perfect little nori eyebrows and ginger nose. And you could taste the love so much. Being aware of how little time she had for it made it taste that much better. I actually have a really good example of, I think I was in first grade and she packed me this beautiful Korean tteokbokki. And I was showing my friends and bragging. And I think in that process, I spilled it on the ground and the rice balls just got sandy. And the amount of guilt and sadness I had, I ate it all. It didn't matter. I picked it off the ground and ate it all. And that's what you do when you know that food is made with love. My grandmother is also, she was a food stylist and a cook in the 60s and 70s. And so food really runs strong in her family. And still, she's 96. And the thing that keeps her alive truly is food. She wakes up every morning at 2 a.m. to watch her favorite cooking show. I don't know why it's on at 2 a.m., but she sits there in the dark writing notebooks of recipes at 96. And every day she's trying something new, cooking something new. She lives alone. It's what motivates her every day. And to me, that's the goal. If I can get to that point where you are so sustained by your love of food and also giving it to other people, because obviously she's just one person. So she's constantly in this act of generosity. She's giving away food, giving it to her children, giving it to her grandchildren. That's a beautiful way to be at 96, I think.
Earlier, we talked about the kind of community that was built around family, or how you modeled the Soon mini community around your family, but you also have modeled it around a kind of broader sense of friendship, collaboration, and expanding community in different ways. And I noticed in the last newsletter for Soon mini, you had extended acknowledgments in that newsletter, thanking numerous folks who've helped you be part of this enterprise and who've shared in doing Soon mini. Could you tell us a little bit about that, about what it's like to create an acknowledged community and this kind of labor that you're talking about, this all body labor inside your business?
I mean, I actually think this is a really core part of Soon mini. Is another leg of this is that I really feel like it's important to have radical different models of employment. And to me, in order to do that, you actually need to practice radical gratitude, which means what is wrong with the food supply chain is that we have traditionally devalued labor. So the reason we can get cheap produce is because we're basically using cheap labor. We're using illegal labor. We're not paying people proper wages. And so we have a distorted sense of what, let's say, a plate of salad costs. But so I think from the ground up, what we need to do is start acknowledging the people that bring food to our plates, start acknowledging farmers, start acknowledging the drivers, every single leg of the supply chain. In tandem with that, because everybody that's worked for Soon Mini so far has done it from the goodness of their hearts, volunteered their time for grocery trade. And to constantly keep that at the forefront of my mind and to know that no one owes me anything, that we are all helping each other, is actual real mutual aid, that it's coming from because you want to do it, not because I'm asking you to do it, not because I'm requiring you to do it, and certainly not because I'm going to be upset if you don't, but only to exist in the plane of gratitude that's been my practice this last year during the pandemic. Be grateful for every moment, for every effort, for every action. And I think when you think that way, you can't help but treat people differently. And you live differently because you are constantly in a state of happiness, of gratitude.
As someone who is so lucky to have you in my life, Sehi, and to have Soon Mini in my life, I'm filled with gratitude. Thank you for your work. And thanks for spending time with us today.
Oh, it's so my pleasure, Karen. Thank you for inviting me, and it's always nice to talk to you.
That was Sehi Cho, writer, cook, stylist, and the entrepreneur behind Soon Mini, a community-driven grocery delivery service. Coming up, do you, like me, love the Great British Bake Off? But were you horrified by this season's Japan Week? You're not alone. We discuss when comfort television gets uncomfortable next. I'm Karen Tongson, filling in for Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. We've all seen the cringe-inducing moments on reality cooking competitions, when the host patronizes a contestant of color or from another background with an inane remark that reveals more about the host's prejudices than the contestant's ability. What is pure escapist television for many can have an undercurrent of racism and, frankly, stupidity for others. Doreen K. Kondo is professor of American Studies and Anthropology and former director of Asian American Studies at the University of Southern California. Indeed, she is a friend and colleague of mine. She's also a dramaturg and playwright, all of which gives her a unique platform to discuss what we're going to call today discomfort TV. Welcome, Doreen.
Thank you so much, KT. It's such a delight to be here.
It's a delight to have you here. And first of all, I want to talk a little bit about our mutual relationships to the Great British Bake Off, which is perhaps one of the most comforting TV shows, or universally lauded as a comforting TV show. And I'm a big fan of the show, and I watch it to ease my mind and listen to the tinkle piano. How about you? What's your relationship to GBBO?
Well, I too am a fan. It's become part of what I also call comfort television, or what some other folks have called ambient television. And particularly during this time of the pandemic and, you know, and the uptick in racialized violence and so on and so forth, there's something innocuous and soothing about it. Somebody even proposed semi-facetiously that Great British Baking Show should serve as a model for the presidential elections, because there's something very cooperative and low-key amongst the contestants. So I, you know, have been using it really as just almost ambient TV. Like sometimes I just keep it on like most of the day, you know what I mean? As background noise. I've seen every episode like easily 5 times, I would say. So I'm a huge fan. And there are also, you know, other things about it. I mean, I think those of us in the U.S. and the other colonies may have what one analyst called colonization of consciousness in a way, but there's something deeply familiar and soothing about the peaceful, stately vision of the pastoral with the manor home and the beautiful verdant lawns and the ducklings, you know, swimming in the pond. And there's also, I think, an important element for me, because to me, the UK is exotic in a certain sense. So they have quirky comedians who express their exotic British humor to me, and a vision of multicultural Great Britain that we will see is not, you know, completely a truthful depiction.
Well, so let's get into that.
Yes.
So yes, it's alluring, it's comforting. There are soft, fuzzy goslings who make us feel warm and fuzzy inside. And then we have these theme weeks. And in particular, during this last season, there was something called Japan Week.
So Japan Week began with a kind of emphasis on what Judge Paul Hollywood, who had been to Japan fairly recently, apparently, you know, called kawaii, the cute aesthetic, you know, Hello Kitty and so on and so forth. And UK Twitter noted that it sounded a lot like kawaii. It was mispronounced, of course, which means scary. And the scary elements of, you know, racism raising its ugly head happened all too often there. So one was certainly the illusion of all of Asia. So Japan became any Asian country. There were contestants making, you know, using Chinese flavors, Thai, you know, whatever it was. Certainly not Japanese in any way. One of the motifs on a kawaii cake was a geisha on the one hand, and then pandas, for example, which are, you know, associated with China, right? So it was just a mishmash. It's the culinary equivalent of we all look alike.
So something that was supposed to be explicitly Japan Week became this kind of jumble of Pan-Asian assumptions, which I don't know. You watch the show. I watch the show. I don't see this happening with, say, French Week.
No. Oh, my God. You know, because that's the thing. It's like there's such deep knowledge of, you know, the intricacies of this or that genre of French baking or British baking or Italian, you know, any European style practically. So Asia becomes this kind of general, like huge world area, so you can more or less bring in anything. So that, once again, is an index of what the post-colonial theorist Gayatri Spivak called zones of sanctioned ignorance. What are you allowed not to know? That becomes part of how a certain kind of power, racial power in this instance, gets perpetuated. It's not that one is overtly discriminatory necessarily. It's just that there's this vast ignorance. It's not accorded the same respect and nuance as you would, say, French cuisine.
Speaking of this, you know, the kind of vastness of assumptions that get ascribed to Asia as a region. One of my most hated terms on food television that, you know, we see in practically every reality competition show is this phrase, Asian flavors.
Absolutely.
And the idea of harnessing said flavors either for success. I know this comes up in a lot of shows like Top Chef, especially if it's a non-Asian chef using Asian flavors. There seems to be a kind of mysticism ascribed to
Absolutely.
What they can accomplish or do, versus the idea of the Asian flavors as sometimes unrecognizable or off-putting, as it were.
Absolutely.
I know that in this particular episode of The Great British Bake Off, there were a lot of scrunched up faces vis-a-vis matcha and yuzu and other ingredients like that. Tell us a little bit about what happened in the show and what you think about this term Asian flavors and how it's worked in the kind of food competition world.
I was particularly struck on the Great British Bake Off in earlier seasons, but also this season, by the inability to appreciate the depth and subtlety of certain kinds of quote-unquote Asian flavors, in this case, Japanese flavors. For example, matcha, which is originally a tea ceremony tea, so very refined and expensive, and you would only have a tiny little scoopful, and there are all these elaborate whisks and so on and so forth in traditional tea ceremony, but now it's become widely marketed. But in season five, the contestant Rav, who had traveled in Japan extensively, brought in matcha and yuzu, a kind of fruit that is neither lemon nor lime. So Judge Paul Hollywood came down on Rav extremely hard. It's like, my mind is trying to decide whether this is lemon or lime. You know, and he was so discombobulated that, you know, he made his comments like very harsh and unpleasant. I mean, he told Rav, watch your flavors. It's like if Hollywood had been a little less provincial, you know, I think Rav would have been evaluated more highly.
Well, it's like yuzu becomes the quote-unquote inscrutable oriental.
Absolutely.
It's the inscrutable oriental flavor to Paul Hollywood, who's like, is it lime? Is it lemon?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, and then matcha becomes also, you know, Mary Berry, the grand dame of British baking, just found matcha grassy.
Which brings me to another, you know, kind of implicit bias question vis-a-vis cooking competition shows and food shows like GBBO. And that's the very concept of meritocracy.
Absolutely.
And the justifications for who stays or who goes resemble how we evaluate performance through the lens of race in other contexts.
Yes, I think it is very much so. And I think it's undergirded by factors that come into play in all settings. Ruha Benjamin, a professor of African American studies at Princeton, calls whiteness as second chances. So, you know, you'll give someone the benefit of the doubt. In this last season, for example, there was a kind of debonair, posh, opera-going, refined, ambitious baker, Rowan, who had great ideas, but he just never finished any of them. And then there was Florence, another white contestant, very pleasant, but she came last in the technical competition. She just seemed like a messy baker, frankly. And this was episode two. There was a South Asian contestant, Makbul, who was very, at that point, solidly in the middle. He had come third in the technical. So that was very good for a second episode. But somehow, because he didn't knock the socks off one of the judges, he was thrown out, basically, or eliminated. In the first episode, it was equally bad because Larea, who had immigrated from Jamaica, I mean, it was just using stereotypes of Black women as excessive. So her flavors were too much. They were too spicy, quote unquote, too loud in a certain way. I mean, it was just, I was just horrified for the first two shows. I mean, it just, I watched, but with such a sense of dread and fear. It's like watching a horror show instead of watching a baking show.
Well, so I did want to emphasize, I know that we've been raining all over the Great British Bake Off, and it's a beloved show,
and we
both love it. But I did want to talk about, I wanted to ask you about this. How is it possible to still derive joy from a show like the British Bake Off while recognizing its flaws and problems? You know, so, you know, what I want to underscore is the conversation we've been having, kind of diving into these issues, is not about canceling things or media that fail at AAPI representation, but I think it's about expecting more out of what we love and enjoy. So could you tell us a little bit about how we can continue to still derive joy from a show like this, even while acknowledging its flaws?
Well, I think it's
What can I say? I mean, I think that minoritized people, along whatever axis, are, that's how we operate. We have to, because there's so little that actually speaks directly to us in a way that we can kind of unambivalently enjoy. So this process of bracketing, like, oh, I don't like that part, but yes, I love this part, is kind of always in place. And it's the kind of extra energy and extra effort, I want to write about this actually, that it takes to find comfort, to find the joy. So there, you know, it is possible. I'm cute. I still love the Great British Baking Show. I keep it on a lot, but I just try not to play those episodes that I know are especially problematic. I just hope that people who are not in a minoritarian position will recognize this kind of extra effort. A friend of mine said, oh, it's like you always have to be braced at every minute. And that's right, I think, even in the comfort of your own home. That said, I think that there are still, you know, possibilities to push these shows that exist. But I think the real answer may be, let's create our own. And let's find places where we can find solidarity and joy and connect with others.
Thanks so much, Doreen, for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you, KT.
That was Doreen K. Kondo. Doreen is a cultural anthropologist and professor of American Studies and Ethnicity and Anthropology at USC. She has authored several books on the topic of gender, race, and power. You can find links to her work at kcrw.com/goodfood.
Karen, I want to thank you so much for that incredible show. It truly was a privilege to share this space with you, and I really hope we can do it again.
It was a pleasure and privilege and honor to be doing the show with you and for you, Evan. You know, I've always been a big listener and fan of Good Food, and it truly is a dream come true to be able to have these conversations alongside you and with the guests we had today.
Take care. Enjoy some relaxation. You deserve it.
You too. Thank you, Evan.
If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, and Desmond Taylor. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, Kenny Ng, Kat Yor, and Gary Masiha. And to our special guest host, Karen Tongson. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back with you in 1 week with an all-new episode of Good Food.